Welcome, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another edition of the Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today has 17 books in print, and she has just published her very first novel, which happens to be a murder mystery. Betty Jean Craig, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Simon.
Before we start in on the book, which incidentally should be on everyone's reading list, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, first I should say that I live with a dog and a parrot. My parrot is an African gray parrot who talks, and she's in the room with me. So if you hear somebody say, "Do you want to go for a walk?" That's not a clone of me because she speaks in my voice, but it's Cosmo. But I grew up in El Paso, Texas. Got my PhD at the University of Washington and came to Athens, Georgia in 1973. I spent 38 years, wonderful years here. I was a professor of comparative literature, and for 18 years I was director of the Wilson Center for Humanities and Arts. And I taught literature. I taught an environmentalist course, ideas about nature, philosophical ideas about nature. And I got interested in art and, you know, history of ideas and environmentalist ideas. And so when I started writing this novel, all of that informed what I was trying to do, which is write an entertaining murder mystery, but one that, would teach people a little bit about a different part of the country, North Georgia, and some ideas that I've been having as a professor.
I have to admit that I was reading your bio. I'm guessing that was Cosmo saying hello.
Yes, Cosmo says hello.
Right.
She's trying to learn on top of Old Smokey, so you may hear that whistling in the background.
I have to ask the question, why the genre of murder mystery? I know that your background is factual books about literature.
So you want to know how I know about murder?
Sure.
And actually, I've never committed one.
Okay, good.
No, so I have to imagine doing that. I loved murder mysteries when I was little, and then I spent my career teaching, great literature, and then I wrote a column about animal cognition and called Cosmo Talks for 2 years, and then in the local paper, and when that got discontinued, Terry Kay, who's a local novelist, told me to write fiction. And so all I could think about was, well, the kind of fiction I really like is murder mysteries. So that's what I did. And I set it in North Georgia. I live in Athens, Georgia, which is kind of in North Georgia, but the North Georgia mountains are really the end of the southern end of the Appalachian Mountains. And it's a beautiful part of the country, and I don't think there are any other murder mysteries set there. So I got a chance to think about the Cherokee Indians who occupied the land for 1,000 years, and the white settlers, the Dahlonega Gold Rush, that was the Georgia Gold Rush of 1828. I got to think of the Trail of Tears, and this part of the country is so rich in history and cultural differences that I thought writing writing an entertaining book in this part of about this part of the world would be, very educational for me and fun for everybody else.
Oh, I enjoyed the book a great deal. I spent several weeks actually watching murder mysteries, primarily out of England. And they have some great series, most of which have been aired on PBS. And I was reading your book, and I kept imagining the setting being in England. Witherston just seemed, such a unique setting.
Well, I had to invent the town. I invented the town of Witherston because, it's named after five generations of a family called Withers. And five generations ago, the first Withers in this part of the country, and I made him up too. I made everything up. It's fun to write a novel. You just make everybody up. But I wanted this generation of very wealthy men, I mean this family, to have never worked. And the Hardy Withers in 1828 panned for gold near Dahlonega, Georgia, and got rich. And then he won the land lottery. This is in 1832 when the state of Georgia gave away the Cherokee land, the land of Georgia, to white settlers in lots of 40 acres. And so then this Hardy Withers passed his money, his wealth, and his land down for five generations. So the last Withers, Francis Hardy Withers, who's 100 years old at the beginning of my novel, has never worked, nor did his father or his grandfather or his great-grandfather or his great-great. So I invented the town Witherston and set it in the mountains.
Right, and you just paint the town in such wonderful words. I mean, it was a joy to reach to read the descriptions, the buildings, the creek. Boy, I just want to go visit it.
Me too. Me too. In my novel, everybody's kind of eccentric, which is kind of normal with me, but nobody's dumb. All my characters are smart characters. They're funny characters, but they're smart. And I think that some writers of Southern fiction have depicted some, less than smart characters, and I don't want the rest of the country to think that we're full of them. That's Cosmo, my bird, whistling on top of Old Smokey. Pardon me, but she'll complain if I put her in the other room.
Oh, no. I think Cosmo is doing great. So,
but I
why
wanted
don't
to
you
say a little. What?
No,
please
carry on.
Well, I also wanted to talk about the North Georgia Mountains is a place that is really fairly free of pollution and pollution, air pollution, water pollution. It's a really wonderful part of the country. But one of the themes of my novel is the pharmaceutical pollution of our environment. And, we're close to the time where we're living on a medicated planet. Because when some of us take drugs that have been prescribed for us, we excrete what we don't need, and it gets into the water supply, and the frogs get five legs, and the fish get happy, and our fellow human beings get drugs that they didn't know they were taking. And so that's part of what's going on in my novel.
Okay. On the subject of the novel, you know my theory about spoilers. So without giving any spoilers, tell us a little bit about the plot line.
Well, I'll just tell the beginning so I don't spoil anything. Old Mr. Withers is 100 years old, and as I said, he comes from a line of Withers, none of whom ever had to work for a living. And he's become a billionaire a couple of times over, and he owes his longevity to a drug, which I invented, but it's probably soon to be available somewhere, called Sinextra. And it's a drug that the people in his retirement community are taking, and it keeps people alive for a long time, well past 100 years old, and it keeps them healthy. And so that raises questions about, what our planet will be like when a lot of us get to, well, some of us, I hope I'm not one of them, get to be well past 100. But anyway, Withers has a meeting with the town, and the town has only 4,000 people in it. And he says that he's made a will, and he's giving a whole $1 billion to the municipality of Witherston, and $1 billion to be divided up among the 4,000 inhabitants, more or less if the town will accept a factory that makes this drug. And so there are demonstrators. Some people are really happy because every resident would get about $250,000. And other people, the environmentalists, are really unhappy. And they carry signs saying we don't need more old men and, keep nature natural and that sort of thing. So Withers gets mad. He says he's going to change his will over Memorial Day weekend. And what do you know? He dies before he gets to change his will. And so that's what the mystery is about. You know, who killed him, why, how, that sort of thing. I must admit, I spent a lot of time on the computer looking up methods of killing. So I sure hope that nobody in my neighborhood dies mysteriously or the cops are going to look at my computer and find out what I've been studying.
Oh, right. As a sometime news reporter, I sincerely hope that no one ever searches my computer. I'll read an article and go, let's see what I can find.
Well, you know, I actually loved writing this novel, and I've written a sequel now, and I'm starting the third. I never knew I'd love writing fiction so much. Writing fiction is like exploration, and, I get deep into a subject and realize that I don't know anything about it, and so I just sit here, Google it, learn a whole lot, go back to the novel, and then I've been informed. In the olden days, when I'd be writing a book, I'd have to write in the morning and then go to the library in the afternoon and do my research, and then I'd come back the next morning. But now, with the internet, you have almost anything you could possibly want if you're writing about the present situation, right there handy with Google or other search engines.
Oh, absolutely. Let's do some shameless commercialization. Where can people buy copies of Downstream?
And I'll explain the title in a minute. Downstream's available both in Kindle and in paperback on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. I live in Athens, Georgia, and our Barnes & Noble store is carrying it in the mystery section. I don't know if it's being carried in other Barnes & Noble, but anybody, any bookstore could order it also. I had originally written the book with the title, We All Live Downstream. And, you know, it's kind of an, I saw that on a bumper sticker, and I thought, wow, that's pretty neat bumper sticker. But the publisher thought that the shorter title, just Downstream, would be more appropriate for a murder mystery. And so I'm not going to let you know what happened downstream.
Oh, right. I think it's a great title. I know the book has only been out for a relatively short period of time, but
about
what
3 weeks.
Sort of as long as that?
Yeah, it's a short period of time.
Right. Are you getting any reader feedback about it?
Well, I am. But, you know, I can't trust it because it's all my friends who are reading it, and they tell me they like it a lot. It's a mystery. It's a real mystery. There are people who get killed, but it's also funny. And, of course, the people in Athens, Georgia, probably everybody loves North Georgia. So they're kind of excited that I've written a book about a part of the country that never gets any attention. And so I hope people in New York and Seattle and Texas, where I grew up, will enjoy reading the book, not just because it's funny, but also because it's set in North Georgia, and also because it's about the medication of our planet.
One of the questions I like to ask fiction authors is about character development, and you do a fabulous job with your characters. Did the character development happen as you were writing, or did you actually develop the characters first so you knew?
They developed as I was writing. Because my novel, because the story is set in North Georgia against a background of Cherokee Indians and five generations of Withers, I had to keep a genealogy chart, you know, in my computer so I could keep all the names of the characters straight. And there are Withers, and they're all fictional, but there are other real characters like President Andrew Jackson and some governors, you know, who were involved along the way. So I had to keep that straight. And then I kept another file of all the characters that I was creating and what kind of car they drove and how old they were and what they looked like, so I could keep that straight. But with respect to their development, as I wrote, I imagined who they were. And now, as I said, I'm starting the third novel in the series, and now the characters are very distinct from each other for me, and I feel like I know them as people. One of the problems I have is that I have more fun writing than reading, which is a very obnoxious thing to say, but every spare minute of the day, and I'm involved in a lot of other things, so I don't have that many spare minutes, I'm at the computer writing my novel because it's a process of discovery. I want to know what happens to my characters. What do they do? Who gets killed? Do they get in dangerous situations and that sort of thing? So it's like I'm reading a novel, but I'm writing it. And, you know, even as I speak to you, I can't wait to get back to the story I'm working on now because I want to know what happens next.
Right.
And also, once you develop the characters, they start carrying a bit of the story. You know, they're real people. They don't act out of character, so you have to tell a story, develop a story in which they're behaving as they would if they were real flesh and blood folks.
Yeah, I was involved in a project a couple of years ago. It was a movie project that required a character to be generated, and I had a lot of fun with it. I created the character, and then I took it one stage further and interviewed the character, you know, in my head. And
oh, that's a great idea. I get it.
Right.
Well, in the second novel in the series, I do have an interview that one character conducts with another character.
Right.
So yeah, it's a great way to bring out ideas and you know the inner thoughts of a character.
You mentioned that there is a second and third book. Presumably, the setting is Witherston again.
Yes, it is. I wouldn't say these are sequels because you could read any of the books out of order. But they're set in Witherston with the characters that I developed in the first novel. And these characters are now very real to me. And as you know, since you've read the novel, they're kind of eccentric. They're kind of funny. I don't make fun of them. I treat them, you know, with affection, you know. There's no satire in my book. I'm not ridiculing anybody. I'm affectionately creating lovable characters who carry out, you know, what they have to do in this story that involves the murder or two. Well, two because that's ambiguous. It's ambiguous.
Indeed. So, what is the likely timeline for publication?
Well, my publisher is Black Opal Books, and they've given me a contract for the second novel. I have a couple of friends who are reading it now, and so I imagine I'll send it to Black Opal Books in January, and I'm hoping it'll be out, you know, maybe in October or November of this coming year. The thing is, once the characters are all developed, you know, I don't want to say they have adventures, but they keep living in my mind, and they get older, and they interact with each other in different ways. There are three characters who are 14-year-old boys in the first novel in Downstream, and they are twins, identical twins, and I had so much fun with them, and I've been inspired by some twin boys whom I know very well, whom I've had many, many conversations with, and so they gave me the idea to have twin boys in the book. And, of course, the boys get older, and they got high school and, you know, have things happen to them. But I don't know what question I'm answering, but all I can say is that the novels start writing themselves once I figure out what the plot is, a little bit about the plot. Because the characters behave in the way their characters should be, do behave.
Right, and this goes back to a question about characters and indeed plot. When you poise your fingers over the keyboard, Do you kind of sort of know the beginning, the middle, and the end?
No.
Or no, all right. Some
people I know
do.
What I want it. Well, I know what, you know, what the theme of my book is. What, and I'm writing about things that are very important to me, you know, dear to my heart. As I said, the first book, it's funny, it's got murders in it, and it's a real puzzle and a real mystery, but it's about the pharmaceutical pollution of our environment. I think that's a very serious issue. And, you know, Valium gets into our water supply, estrogen, antidepressants, and so we're all getting some of that, and, you know, it affects our health. So that's an issue that I've thought very deeply about. I'm also thinking deeply about some other issues. I don't want to give away the stories of other things, but I have an idea when I start about the theme. I have the initial situation, and I have an idea of who the bad guy is going to be and who gets killed. And then I just start writing. It's hard to write a mystery. I mean, anybody would say that. But I learned that I have to have the climax at a particular point in the story. The story has to have an interesting structure. It has to have suspense to keep the readers reading. I have to play fair with the reader, planting clues so that the reader has a pretty good chance of guessing who the murderer is and what happened by the end of the book, but not so many clues that the reader guesses on page 35 and puts the book down. And then, you know, the reader has to have a good time figuring it out. One reason I like murder mysteries, I've enjoyed reading them, is that I like to be engaged in figuring something out. And the good murder mystery gets the reader totally engaged and doing some intellectual work. And I think that's what I want to create, a novel or novels that are entertaining but that require the reader to do some intellectual work, because it's pleasurable to do intellectual work and, you know, be satisfied at the end that you've accomplished something as a reader, you know, as a writer.
I sat and read the book, and I was pretty convinced I had the whole thing solved, and then I wasn't, and then I was, then I wasn't. I took many, many blind alleys.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what you want in a book.
Yeah, you don't want it to be too easy, but you want the writer to play fair. You know, you don't want to work through 300 pages and on page 310 have a new character come in and say, "Well, I did it. I killed the guy." That's not fair.
No.
And then it makes the reader mad at the writer.
Right. The first thing that popped into my mind was, we don't have any suspects. Well, yes, we do. We got 4,000 of them. And for one reason or another, all 4,000 might be tempted to get rid of old Mr. Withers.
Before he changes his will.
Yes. In some ways, that is the hook. It's a term I use, you know, when reading a novel. The writer has to hook the reader early on, because if
right.
you don't, they put the book down and move on to something else, and you get the hook in very early.
I'm an impatient person, and when I start reading a book, if I don't get hooked, by page 30, I put it down. I'm in a mystery lunch group that I formed a couple of years ago of just some close friends. We read mysteries, and today one of them said, that long book, I hated that book. I hated it from start to finish, and I thought, why finish a book you hate? Because I don't, or if I don't like a movie, I don't finish it, because I feel my time's really precious. So in writing, I've got to hook the reader right away, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Yep. So sales. I view books as being a three-part process. They're all hard, and each one gets harder. It's hard to write the book. It's harder still to find a publisher. And then you come up against the dreaded M word, marketing, the hardest part of all. What sort of marketing strategy do you have? Like online, book signings, that sort of thing?
Well, I like the writing part the best, as you can imagine. I love interviews like this, where potential readers can hear us talk about the book. I hope I get some reviews. My bird, Cosmo, has a Facebook page. Cosmo has 5,000 friends, so I mentioned it on Facebook. And one of the characters has a parrotlet. That's a Pacific parrotlet. That's a small bird. Everybody suspects that I'm going to put parrots in all my books, and probably I will. In the second mystery, there's an African gray parrot. So I'm using Cosmo's, my parrot's website, and my parrot's Facebook page to advertise. But I'm not. My other books are academic books, and you don't have to market them. I mean, the academic world takes charge. So I'm not very accustomed to marketing books, and that I don't find that a lot of fun. I did a couple of book signings in Athens, but I don't want to travel somewhere because I don't want to go 500 miles to sell, 30 books.
Right.
The world has changed. I think the best way to market it is, by email and by website and things like that.
And do you actually have a website for downstream?
Yes, I do, and it's in the process of being completed, but there's a lot on it already. And the website address is very simple. It's just Betty Jean Craig, all one word, .com. My name's spelled Betty, BettyJeanCraige, and that's all one word. Craig has an E on it. And so that'll take you to the website, and I'm putting more and more stuff on the website. But, yes, it's my own website. This is the first time I've ever had my own website. I don't even have my own Facebook page. So, but I do write on a computer.
So Cosmo's the technical side
of things. You can't imagine how many fanatical parrot lovers there are in the world. People who have parrots love their parrots. I mean, I hope they love them because these birds are so intelligent and sensitive. So most parrot lovers want to find other parrot lovers and exchange ideas and that sort of thing. And that's why Cosmo's website and Cosmo's Facebook page are very popular. I don't know if I will ever achieve the popularity that my bird has, but so my bird and I are competing. I wrote another book about Cosmo called Conversations with Cosmo, and it was about how this wonderful African gray parrot developed a sense of humor, developed speech, intelligent speech, and what she thinks about and, you know, what she does. So that's when I broke away from academic writing and sort of relaxed my writing style. And then it was fairly easy to go from that book into fiction.
Wow. that's quite the story. I will have to get myself a copy of Conversations with Cosmo. It certainly sounds like it.
Then you might end up getting yourself a bird.
Ah. Well.
But anyway, go ahead.
Well, actually, I have to ask the question. You said that parrots can live to a grand old age. What persuaded you to become the proud owner of Cosmo?
Oh, I had friends who kept telling me about their birds, and so one of my friends took me to a pet shop where he'd seen these baby African gray parrots, and I make up my mind real quickly, and I bought Cosmo when she was 6 months. She didn't speak till she was a year old, and that's normal. And then her first word was bird, and I was so surprised that she was speaking. I didn't pay much attention. Then she said, Cosmo is a bird. And then, in an hour, she was saying all the things I'd said to her all fall. You know, Cosmo is a good bird. Cosmo want to go to kitchen. Cosmo want to kiss. I love you, and that sort of thing. So she learned very quickly. The whole 6 months I'd had her before she started speaking, she, like any infant, was absorbing the speech and starting to understand it. And then she just started speaking and speaking and speaking. And, we have a whole lot of fun. You know, her first joke was, telephone for bird. You know, she'd been saying telephone for Betty Jean, and then said telephone for a bird, and she and I laughed and laughed. That was so funny. And then another joke she tells is when I start to kiss my dog, she says, my dog's named Mary. She says, Mary has feathers. Hee, hee, hee. So she thinks that's an insult. But anyway, so I have a lot of fun, and I'm going to be writing more about Cosmo in a future novel. And not about Cosmo, but about parrots and animals. And you may have noticed that there are a whole lot of pets in the book downstream. Lots of animals.
Yes.
They all have funny names. By the way, it sure is fun to name characters. And I have to Google every name that I invent to make sure that I'm not using a name that somebody else owns, because
right,
I would not
like,
want to do that and get sued, especially when I'm naming chickens.
Like Bill Gates.
Yeah, there's no character named Bill Gates. But
I'm looking at the clock, and we're fresh out of time. Betty Jean, I want to really thank you for talking to us today, and wish you every success with Downstream, and I'm looking forward to the next two books in the series.
I'm looking forward to writing them too, and publishing them. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Simon. thank you so much, and I'm glad you liked the book.
Oh, loved it. Okay, till next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy and healthy day and week, and a very merry Christmas. We'll be back again soon. Till next time, goodbye.